Do you notice that all of our hero stories begin with tragedy at the beginning? Spider-Man and Batman were both orphaned at a young age when their parents were killed in tragic circumstances. And moments before Krypton was blown up, the baby Superman's parents put him into a space lifeboat, which then crash-landed on Earth. Which is kind of what happened to Moses. Because Moses' story also began with tragedy. Moses was born in ancient Egypt some 3,500 years ago. The Egyptians called Moses' people the Hebrews, probably meaning the people who crossed over, maybe what we would today call migrants. Moses was ancestors to the Jewish people, a descendant of Joseph's family of sheepherders, who 400 years earlier migrated to Egypt as refugees because of a severe famine. There's a record in China of a seven-year famine around the same time, which suggests that maybe the famine in Joseph's story might have been very far-reaching. Joseph is another hero story with tragic origins, but what an amazing story. A nomadic shepherd boy becomes the prime minister of Egypt. And through some kind of divine arrangement, he saved Egypt from famine along with his own family. By Moses' time, 400 years later, the Bible says there was now a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. It's hard to believe. A Pharaoh who didn't know the history of his own country. It's the opinion of some Jewish scholars that it's not really that he didn't know, but that he didn't want to know. He wanted to rewrite the history of his country and erase the historical contribution of the Hebrew settlers within his borders. Joseph's people were now slaves in Egypt, doing all the jobs the Egyptians didn't want to do. And Moses was born during genocide. The Pharaoh became concerned about the slave population, and it's not just the size of the ethnic group, but it's also that the Egyptian economy had become so dependent on the slave labor force, the Pharaoh was worried about them leaving or secretly cooperating with one of Egypt's enemies to bring down his kingdom. So the Pharaoh's solution to his fear was to order all male children to be drowned at birth. It should horrify us that the Pharaoh thought Hebrew babies were somehow less of a human life than Egyptian babies, that his anxiety justifies such inhumane and cruel actions, that senseless murder could ever be a legitimate use of power. But the plan didn't work. The Hebrew midwives wouldn't cooperate. So then the Pharaoh deputized all Egyptians to go ahead and help with murdering Hebrew baby boys. Imagine that. That any Egyptian could take matters into their own hand to end a life just because of the racial origin of the baby, with no concerns for repercussions. So into this world, Moses was born. The Hebrew Bible describes Moses as goodly looking to his parents. He was apparently pretty. It's the same expression used to describe the young Joseph and why his boss's wife chased them around the house. Moses' parents just could not imagine someone killing their pretty baby, so they hid him for 3 months until they couldn't hide him anymore. So somebody came up with this Hail Mary plan. They made a little ark out of a basket, and they dropped it with Moses in it into the river along among the reeds, and then crossed their fingers. I'm pretty sure none of us have concrete memories from 3 months old, but then again, who knows what we can or cannot carry around in our subconscious? A psychologist friend of mine told me a client of his during therapy retrieved this vague memory that is attached to some very scary emotions, but he just couldn't place when this thing happened in his life. So when this man told his mother about this vague memory, his mother says, "Oh, how did you know about that? That happened to me when I was pregnant with you." Maybe that's the way it was with Moses. Even though he had no memory of being dropped into the river, It may be that he remembered how it felt when his mother closed the lid on him and sealed him into that claustrophobic darkness. It was so frightening that when the basket floated to where the Pharaoh's daughter was bathing, she could hear him screaming and wailing, and it's why she went to see where the crying was coming from. So what was your childhood like? What's in your origin story? Unfortunately, unlike comic books, our traumatic beginnings don't usually prepare us to become superheroes. They just leave us with a lot of psychological messes to sort out in counseling. I read this article in Psychology Today on how childhood trauma impacts our identity development. Our identity is what gives us our sense of self-esteem, the confidence that we're good enough, and how we weave between our emotions and our intellect to make sense of what we feel. A healthy identity helps us to feel secure and coherent as individuals, so we know who we are. My mom was born in 1939, a few years before the Second World War, when the world powers were already rearranging themselves to go to war. 8 hours after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, invasion forces moved into Hong Kong and took siege over everyday life for a few years until the end of the war 4 years later. During this time of occupation, everything became super expensive. That is, if you can even find things to buy. And there were other wartime kind of horror. So when my mom was born, her parents had a bad feeling about what was coming, so they decided they needed to get away. My mom's family escaped into China right after she was born. She said there was no time to get a birth certificate. So for the first few years of her life, they kept running between a province near Hong Kong to Shanghai and just trying to keep ahead of the danger. She remembers being very hungry, waiting for this uncle from a nearby village to come on his bicycle every few days if he had extra vegetables in his garden. And she remembers being in Guangzhou City, where every night American warplanes would fly overhead to bomb the place. So every night, they would have to run to the bomb shelter, her mom carrying her, a maid carrying a bag of money, and her dad hanging on to her brother and an uncle, one on each hand. According to that Psychology Today article, painful childhood memories affect the way we feel and express pain. So we see this in Moses' life. Among other things, he had a temper. He could kill someone if he got angry enough. And he broke the first stone tablets that the Ten Commandments were written on, and he beat the life out of a rock trying to get water to come out of it. His counselor would say all of this rage have roots in his traumatic childhood. Do you watch Kim Convenience on the CBC? The guy who plays the son in the Korean family is actually Chinese. And he talks about the anger, sadness, and resentment he carried around because of his childhood. He was born in China in the late 80s. Around the time when he was born, his dad got this very rare invitation to go and study at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. So his parents went for it. And for the first 5 years of his life, he was left with his grandparents in China. He remembered his grandparents as kind and gentle people, and in some confusing way, these old folk felt like his parents. And then when he was five, some stranger man showed up to take him to Canada, and was told to call this man Dad. He says when he moved to Canada, his parents made him feel like a defective product. His dad was always angry, trying to reprogram him from his grandparents' upbringing. He and his dad would fight all the time. His dad called him clumsy if he tripped. His dad called him stupid if he didn't get an A. And his dad yelled at him for wasting his time hanging out with friends. He said his dad felt like a stranger to him. But now, as a grown-up, he looks back and he realizes that he probably felt like a stranger to his dad. When the stranger Egyptian princess pulled Moses out of the water, she decided to adopt this pretty baby boy and save him from the Pharaoh. And through a bit of clever intervention by Moses' sister, Moses' Jewish mother was hired to breastfeed this infant Moses. And then when he was done breastfeeding, say 2.5 years old or something like that, he was then handed back to the princess to be raised in the palace as her son. The princess named him Moses, which in Egyptian means son. But it also sounds like the Hebrew word for pull from the water. Can you imagine Moses looking at his two mothers at the handover? Growing up, does he think of himself as Egyptian or as a Hebrew? What did he feel sitting in the palace, school, with other princelings? Did he feel like he fit in? Or did he feel like what I felt as an immigrant kid, that constant awareness of distance between you and everyone else? Every time his name was called, did he hear son in Egyptian? Or water rescue boy with a Hebrew accent? By the time he was a young man, the Bible says he rejected the palace life. He was done with not fitting in, so he went to his people and watched them in the hard labor. So here was Moses, dressed like an Egyptian man, I guess, yet somehow felt this kinship with the slaves. So when he saw an Egyptian bullying a Hebrew, he took the Hebrew side of the argument, and his anger flared up, and he killed the Egyptian. But how confusing then, when he tried to stop two Hebrew men from fighting, they accused him of not being one of them. "Who made you prince to judge us?" they said. So then he ran away to the wilderness. Apparently, another sign of childhood trauma, to distance oneself from other people in close relationships and just live the life of a loner. His identity confusion is maybe the reason why when God came and started a conversation with him from a burning bush, when God informed him that he has been given the job to go and negotiate with the Pharaoh to free the slaves, his response to God was, "Who am I?" I think you and I would have asked, "Who are you, burning bush, that you think you can challenge the Pharaoh?" He will ask that question later. But isn't it interesting that the first question to God is, "Who is Moses?" Maybe it's one part, "Why would you pick me for this? Don't you know I'm a nobody? I live in a tent and 10 sheep in the wilderness. Don't you know what a mess I've made of my life? I'm not no superhero. You got the wrong guy." And maybe he's also asking, "Wait, do you know who I am? You know me? Do you know the answers about the missing pieces of me, the answers to questions I have about me, why I feel so confused inside and where I fit in the world and what I'm supposed to be doing in the world? What is it you know and see in me that I don't see? Could you explain me to me?" So this is the paradox of Moses' life. This is the conflicted person who became the most important person in Jewish history. Every year since that moment, some 35 years ago, 3,500 years ago, Jewish family would once a year during Passover come around the dinner table to retell the story of the rescue from Egypt. They would remember Moses as the one who received the law from God on stone tablets and gave them to the people. And yet, we don't get the feeling from his burning bush conversation with God that he felt very heroic or brave. This brings us to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 reads like a hall of fame of faith. It sounds like that. But thinking about Moses' conversation with God at the bush makes me wonder if the writer really intends for us to admire these people as faith heroes. I mean, is this chapter even about these people? I played a lot of tennis in high school. For a while, I wanted to be Bjorn Borg, if you're old enough to remember who he is. I don't know why you're laughing at my childhood dream. For most of us, sports hall of fames are filled with people we dream of becoming when we were kids. But then only at some point we realize those are pipe dreams. We're not talented as those athletes, and no amount of hard work can make us into them. So sports hall of fame are like museums of crushed dreams. These are the people there just remind us what we're not and can never become. But this cannot be the intention for Hebrews 11. This is not meant to be some hallowed shrine of extraordinary human achievement. This is a list of people who relied on God. So the hero of this chapter is actually God and what God does when we put our ordinary, tiny faith in him. So a faith hall of fame, it's a funny thing. It's a list of people, but it's not really about them. It's what God did through them. They were the people God showed himself faithful through. And for the most part, this list of people were bumbling boneheads just like us. Moses certainly wasn't someone looking to change the world or make history. Since running away to the wilderness, he was very content keeping company with sheep. Compare Moses to the Chinese president. When Xi was 15, the communist government closed all the schools and ordered millions of young people to go and live in the countryside, to live the peasant life as a sort of education. So the young Xi was sent to live in a cave. Well, something happened in that cave, so that when he emerged 7 years later, he declared that he was no longer anxious and confused like a teenager, and his goals were firm and now filled with confidence. So he decided on a political career, and at 21, he joined the Communist Party and began to quietly climb the ladder all the way to the top now as the unopposed leader of one-fifth of the world's population. In contrast, Moses' move to the countryside did nothing for his ambition. That's why when God informed Moses he's been chosen for this rescue mission, every instinct in his body was to refuse. He's not a good speaker, he kept saying. The Hebrew expression there describes a mouth with too much skin, clumsy lips that get in the way of speaking. Some scholars think he stuttered. Would it surprise you that difficulty with speaking is yet another sign of childhood trauma? The painful childhood experiences can make us tongue-tied because too much overwhelming feelings come up all at once when we try to express ourselves. But as Moses made a protest to God, interestingly, we see that God started to shift the conversation away from what Moses cannot do to what God can do. So at some point, when Moses finally asked God which God he was, who should I say sent me when people asked, Moses wanted to know, God said, I am that I am. Hebrew is a funny language. It has no tenses. Chinese is like that. So you have to deduce the tense from context. So I am that I am. You can go play around at home this afternoon. So I am that I am can mean I am who I was. To Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, or I am who I always am because I never change. But this is the important one. I am who I will be. Or from this clunky Hebrew translation, I will be there howsoever I will be there. That is God telling Moses, this is who I am. When you go to Pharaoh, and when you eventually trek through the wilderness to get to the promised land, whatever challenge you will run into that feels too big for you, I promise I will become howsoever you need me to be. Isn't that good? That God's name is a promise to us that as we persevere through the potholes and detours and dead ends of our lives, God promises to become howsoever we need him to be. And the Exodus story told through Moses is just that. God showing up when they needed him to. Like when they got pinned between the Red Sea and the Egyptian army, God showed up and parted the sea for them to walk through. Or when they came upon this fortress-like walls of Jericho, God showed up and brought down the walls without any of them having to swing a sword. God did these superhero things. It wasn't Moses. So Moses is on this faith list not because he had extraordinary faith, but because God is extraordinarily faithful. God promises to be howsoever we need him to be in the things we run into in wilderness life. And if Moses is just like one of us, you know what that means? Hebrews 11 may not be a close list. We have a shot at getting our names appended to the bottom of that list, because it's not about us at all. After all, it's about what God does through us if we let him. When we get to heaven, if God shows us his copy of the Bible, and if we find our names appended on the bottom of his Hebrews 11 list, it would mean that we have learned to master one thing about faith. And that is to give God the benefit of the doubt when the going gets tough. Hebrews 11 begins by defining faith as being sure of what we hope for. I don't know about you. I don't think I know what that feels like. And honestly, it doesn't seem like Moses felt that either. But for us doubting Thomases, what I think we can muster up is giving God the benefit of the doubt when we don't have the benefit of certainty, when we really don't know how things will turn out for us, when we're skeptical and unsure like Moses was. When we have no confidence in the outcome, what we can do is pivot and put our faith on God and just give him the benefit of doubt. To take God at his word that he will show up and become howsoever we need him to be, so we can get through whatever we need to get through. Because in the end, it's not about our ability to hold faith. It's about God's faithfulness in holding on to us. A couple of weeks ago, I preached in a church in Abbotsford. Last year when I went there, I met this man who had been a pastor. But now, he tells me, he's struggling with his faith. So this time when I went, he stood up after the sermon, because they have this sharing time. He stood up after the sermon to share something. It sounded like to me he's still struggling with his faith. But he read out something from that morning's devotion that was comforting to him in his struggle. I couldn't help but wonder on the long, lonely drive home whether there was anything really wrong with his faith, or if the problem is just that his expectation of how faith is supposed to make us feel confident and sure. Sure, some people feel that. Maybe what he feels is how faith is going to feel for the rest of us. That faith is less of a feeling of certainty, but a decision to keep trusting God anyways. That in our feebleness, we lean with our full weight on God, that he would show up and be howsoever we need him to be, the way we collapse into a chair when we're exhausted, believing it would hold us up. So, as boneheads, we read Hebrews 11 as a list of people who managed to give God the benefit of the doubt when God asked something hard of them. And if we're willing to give God the benefit of the doubt, when it is hard to trust God, when life gets hard, then we're exactly the kind of people God can do something with. And God may also have an assignment for us that we're uniquely suited for. So you know, Superman is called the Man of Steel. Well, when Moses' story was written down eventually, he was awkwardly referred to as Moses the Man. As opposed to what? The Moses the pet camel? Or is it a compliment? I don't know. But perhaps the man is there to remind everybody that he was just one of us, bumbling and imperfect and broken. And somehow, that's exactly the kind of people God likes to work through. So, Jesus takes God's I am that I am and expanded it to 7 I am statements in John, beginning in chapter 6. So I thought I would just close by inviting you to listen to these and see which one of these is howsoever we need him to be for what we are contending with at the moment. So you can bow if you want to. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. I'm the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. He will come in and go out and find pasture. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I'm the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, and though he dies, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I am the vine. You are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. God, this morning we tell you that we believe in you. We believe in you when you promise that you will be howsoever we need you to be. We believe in you enough to give you the benefit of the doubt when things feel too hard for us. Help us in our unbelief. Amen.